This program is sponsored by Cane Vineyard and Winery. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we talk about food through the lens of taste. Not just food, really, but taste in general and the importance of aesthetic judgments in the quality of our lives. And we're here today, broadcasting from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, with one of the great makers of taste, really. In the last, certainly in my lifetime, Madhur Jaffrey, a wonderful cookbook writer, in addition to a great screen actress, and just an all-around wonderful person. Thank you for joining us out here on a rainy day in Brooklyn.
It's wonderful to be here.
thank you for saying that, even though I'm not sure you believe it yet.
No, I believe it. It's a wondrous place that I'm in. I couldn't imagine what would happen when I parted the curtains, and there, behold, in front of me was a lovely restaurant.
Indeed, and a great restaurant, and I hope we'll be able to enjoy it. One of the funny things, we're sitting in a shipping container really attached to that restaurant, and I've just come back from London where there's this great shopping area called Box Park, which is made up of shipping containers stacked on top of each other. Very fun. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about really what I find interesting, I think, as a topic with you, and we get a chance to chat once in a while, is sort of the changes that have gone on in America, some of which you have helped make, when it comes to food and the sophistication we have with different cuisines, and particularly with Indian food. And I wonder what you think, sitting here in this crazy place in Brooklyn, about what's gone on, what you've seen in New York and elsewhere in your days.
Well, when I came to America, there was really no decent Indian food. There were some pathetic little restaurants. I remember one or two in the Times Square area. We went there because that was the only thing that there was. But I remember one that was all done up like a fake temple with styrofoam that had been painted like pillars, and the food was equally styrofoamy as far as I was concerned. But things have changed over time. Better and better and better restaurants have come. And now I think Indians have the courage in America to start exploring, to do fusion cuisine, which is really shows their comfort level.
Sure.
That they can say, this is what we do, but we're going to do something that's a little more mixed. So beginning to see, with Tabla, we saw the first major fusion restaurant. Mm-hmm. And they're beginning to see it in dessert restaurants. We're beginning to see it in little snacky restaurants. So it's a mixture of East and West now. Wraps of various sorts with Indian fillings. So people are combining. It's not just American and Indian, but Mexican, Korean. Mm-hmm. All this is getting mixed up together. Sometimes very wonderfully, and sometimes not so.
Right. There is good and bad food everywhere.
Yeah.
But you certainly brought the flavors of Indian cuisine into the home, not even just the restaurant. I mean, your books are so accessible and made something that seems so difficult part of the natural order of things. You know, you want to make a quick vegetable dish one day, you turn to one of your books and find something to do with, I don't know, with tomatoes and chickpeas or whatever. I mean, the relationship we have, the familiarity you've given us, I think, with some of these flavors and ingredients has been really unique and changed a lot of how we think of food.
Well, I hope I've done that. I feel when I work, I'm a one-woman band. I buy the cauliflower, whatever it is, myself. I chop it up myself. I test it myself with a notebook in hand, and then I write. So I've worked by myself, and I learned only to trust myself where recipes goes. And I write them because I started cooking when I didn't know how to cook at all. Not a bit. So I feel that I'm always addressing the person who doesn't know, especially how to cook Indian food and the approaches to Indian food. So I tell them everything that they need to know. And I think that gives them a little confidence. And that has helped the home cook. And I find a lot of people I run into. And the wonderful thing for me is that my first cookbook came out in 1973. And there are three generations now,
right,
who have been cooking it. The people bought it then, cooked for their children. Their children are now cooking that food for their children. And I've run into people who've told me this, that my mother used to cook for me and now I'm cooking for my children.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is amazing.
And so you believe people are still cooking? We hear a lot of some of our guests say, oh, no, everyone just eats out and orders in and whatever. The people you encounter obviously aren't doing that.
Well, I just met someone today who said she's cooked 25 years from my books. So, I mean, I think people are eating out more. That is true. But people are also cooking more.
Right. So a general interest in food. Certainly, I think here in Brooklyn, which is it become in some ways a ground zero for not even artisanship as much as wonkishness about food and an intense desire to know and to have done it yourself and to try to make your own pickles and I presume to try
That's
to make
right.
your own Indian condiments and all that sort of stuff.
People are doing it and they've always done it. I think it's a mistake to think that people just don't do it. People go out, but they also cook.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right, and one informs the other, I think. I've always felt that if you cook, you have a better respect and appreciation for what you eat out and a better
That's
idea
right.
of what value is.
Well, certainly. I mean, when I go out and eat something, I say, oh, I like that aspect of this. I'll try and reproduce it at home. Mm-hmm. I think other people must do the same.
Probably not as deftly as you, but I'm sure they do. Let me remind other people listening at home that they can call in with questions here to the studio at area code 718-497-2128. You can also email us questions for if you have anything you'd like to ask Matt or Joffrey at info@heritageradionetwork.com. If you're one of the first, second, or third generations who've enjoyed her food or her films, and we'll get to that later. You can also, if you're listening to us on the podcast, which is a very popular way for people to hear the show, you can tweet us at Taste Matters, HRN. That's our Twitter handle. And we'll look forward to hearing from you and answering your questions on air. So let's go back to something you just said. You didn't know how to cook, and you've become one of the great cookbook authors of our time. Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
It always amazes me. I can't believe it happened. But I think if you have a palate, then from birth, practically, you're absorbing tastes and flavors, and they're going into some file in your head. And I think then I came to London, I was like 20 years old, and suddenly wanted food that I was brought up with. Nobody was cooking it in London in the late 50s, I'm talking about. And I had to make it myself. So I wrote to my mother, and she sent me little recipes, and there were three-line recipes. Take a little bit of this, and like cauliflower, take a little bit of cumin, take a little bit of ginger, and sauté this and that. And it was there were three-line recipes. And I started that way, but I think because I remembered the exact taste of my mother's food, I could reproduce it by trial and error.
In one paragraph, you've just justified my whole show, which is this idea that taste is not just some frivolous indulgence, but it's actually something, it's a way of filtering the world in some ways.
Absolutely. And people are born with eyes to distinguish a good painting from a bad painting, ears to distinguish good music, and a palate, which takes taste in and records them. Mm-hmm. And I've become a firm believer in this over the years because I've seen it in my own life. And the way I recreate dishes is by remembering how they tasted and just trying them out and try and get the exact flavor.
Mm-hmm. So I presume that you don't only just cook and enjoy Indian food, that you live in New York City and the world is your oyster, so
Absolutely,
to speak.
And I've traveled. And every time I take on a travel assignment, it's partly to learn. I'm just so curious about how the world eats. And as you travel to Japan or to Southeast Asia, you're picking up the links which link us all together. We are not isolated, as we think. Everything we eat comes from somewhere. And it's not necessarily from under our feet, not necessarily grown 2 feet away or 10 yards away. It has traveled. We have got wheat from one area of the world, Mesopotamia. That's where wheat originated. And it moved around. Rice originated somewhere and moved around. Chilies originated in this world and moved to our world. And we think of it as our food, but it's originally not. So we're all so superbly linked to each other. That is a joy to travel and to find these links. And you find even in the names, I don't know how, if people should just study the names of things.
Names of dishes and ingredients?
Of dishes and ingredients. For example, when I was in Trinidad, they were calling a kind of coriander that grows there, culantro, I think is the word that mm-hmm. they use. They were calling it bandhania. The Indians who had moved there, who had been taken there as indentured labor, which is the coriander of the woods. Hmm. It was not what they were grown up with, but it tasted like green coriander, mm-hmm. and they were calling it coriander of the woods. So if you look at the development of words also, it is just so interesting to see how things change and people adapt, but they look for what they grew up with, but they can't find it and they change it. Hmm.
You've touched on something that I think makes your books unique and your worldview, presumably, and that is that you are not codifying the definitive XYZ, this is the only way it's done, or this region of the world. And there is a genre and an amazing group of books and cookbook writers who do that and sort of, for posterity's sake, record how something's done in one place and how it hasn't changed and all that sort of thing. But your books, perhaps because of the process you described of coming through taste and your experience, they reflect this sort of changing language of food. They're not, it is a little of this and a little of that. And you can see that you've lived in New York a long time when you put apples and carrots in your raita. You've just changed things with where you are. Can you say a little bit about that? I mean, a little more about that?
Well, I think that happens everywhere. Mm-hmm. When the British came to India, they wanted an apple pie, and they couldn't necessarily in every city get the apples that they were used to. Mm-hmm. So they used green mango, and the green mango pie developed.
That sounds good.
it's very good. And then I was in the Philippines. Just to follow the same pie thing through, I was in the Philippines where they couldn't probably get very good apples, so they used guavas, which the Spaniards had brought to them. Mm-hmm. And they were making wonderful guava pies. I can tell you, you would die for that guava pie. So people change things according to what they can manage, what they can do, and they try and get it in a kind of authentic flavor. But in India, I'm sure it was a slightly Indian flavor. And in the Philippines, it's definitely a kind of Philippine flavor mm-hmm. that they get into their pies.
And do you, when you are looking either to create a recipe or even just to make dinner, do you reach to similar flavors, or are you just always in the mood for new things? Like what are the smells emanating from the Jaffrey apartment in the village?
Well, you know, with me, it's exactly what I feel like eating that day, because we eat a lot at home. So the other day I was feeling like artichokes. Mm-hmm. Just desperate. And the artichokes are very good these days. Mm-hmm. So I went and bought two juicy-looking artichokes. And then I remember an Italian friend who had a restaurant. I can't remember his name, Alberto's. Remember, he was on Hudson. He opened a restaurant on Hudson.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, he used to do, once he served me this dish. It was in a broth. It was like in a chicken broth. And I remember that there were onions in the broth, there was garlic in the broth, and there was a lot of flat leaf parsley and olive oil. Mm-hmm. So it was basically chicken stock and all these mm-hmm. things. Now, whether he'd baked it or cooked it, I don't know. But I have made my version mm-hmm. of that dish since that time, maybe 25 years ago. And I made that, and it was delicious. Mm-hmm. It was delicious. I just felt like this particular artichokes in this kind of broth.
Right.
So that's what I made.
So you cook to a craving. It's funny, I just came back from a few days in Florence, Tuscany, where we've had the pleasure of meeting up years ago, and it's so clearly artichoke season in a way that we don't really understand here, I think. You can't get away from them.
No.
Every special, every restaurant, everything is artichokes. Yes. Is there a seasonality to Indian cooking
also? Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. Cauliflower is winter, and you associate all the great cauliflower dishes in the winter. Winter is also the time for mustard seed greens.
Oh.
Mustard greens. Mm-hmm. So in the Punjab, they have a specialty dishes, which is a kind of cornbread that they make with cornmeal, and they eat it with the mustard greens, which are also thickened slightly with a little cornmeal.
Mm.
And this mustard greens, chilies, it is so yummy, I can't tell you.
It sounds great.
and
another evidence of new world effect, in the old, because corn couldn't have been there before.
That's right. And when I've been to the Punjab where corn is grown, I remember standing in the university, in the capital of Punjab, and talking about corn, and professors were saying to me, but we've always had corn. It's from here. I said, it's not. It's just not from here.
Right. Yes, on that, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Madhur Jaffrey about, I guess, the world of taste.
All of us at Cane Vineyard and Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to cane5.com.
You are back listening to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and we're talking to Madhur Jaffrey, who was excited to be listening to Punjab Bhangra music in our break. Well-timed, although I'm not sure we knew exactly how well-timed
to the
conversation.
It was perfectly timed because I've just been talking about makki di roti, which is corn bread, and sarson da saag, which is greens, mustard greens, together in the winter in the Punjab, and then came this Punjabi song all about Punjab.
Awesome. Kudos to our producer, Jack Inslee. Let me remind people, you can call us at 718-497-2128 or write us a question at info@heritageradionetwork.com. You can also tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. So anyone I know who writes cookbooks these days would be happy to have written one or even maybe two of the sorts of books you have. And you have written how many books?
You know, I can't keep it straight.
Okay.
Let's say 20, give a little or take a little.
Okay, 20, give a little or take a little. That would easily fit into the great books of cookbooks of the last 30 years, 40 years. And you're at work on another project.
Yeah, I'm working on a very exciting project for me. This is all set in Britain. Oh. And it's called Curry Nation. And it is very interesting that we were colonized by the British for several hundred years. Mm-hmm. And then the British left after dividing the country into three little bits. Goodbye, here are your three little bits.
That worked well.
Then Indians and Pakistanis and Bangladeshi started immigrating. Immigrating, which one is it? Whatever one it is, to England. And slowly, the food began to change. And the favorite food in Britain now is curry. You cannot go to a pub. You cannot go to a cafeteria. You cannot go anywhere without having some kind of Indian curry. And I found it so interesting. I knew that in the north of England, they have chips, which is French fries with curry sauce. I knew that. Oh. It's a ghastly curry sauce, but there you are. But now, this time I heard something else. I heard a little story by, I was also doing a film in England a little earlier, and my makeup lady was telling me the story. She was Welsh, and she said, she told me about this English actor who went into a restaurant in London. He was visiting London, and he said, could I have a chicken vindaloo off and off? And so the waiter said, what do you mean off and off? He said, off and off. And the guy wouldn't understand. He said, with half rice and half chips. So this is how they have it in Wales. They get an Indian curry, but on the side, they ask for off and off, which is half rice and half chips, and they mix it all up together and eat it. So since then, I think I'm going to my book, The Curry Nation, is going to start with the story about off and off.
Someone listening needs to open a shop here, I think. You could put it in a bun and then deep fry it, and we'd have a whole new thing.
Exactly, we have a whole new thing.
So is this a prose book, or is it a cookbook, or both?
Well, this is, there are 10, it's two things. It's a television series. It's a 10-part television series. And we're going around the country of Britain, you know, Scotland, Wales, everything, and showing what people are eating.
Wow.
From the pure Indian food to bastardized new British Indian food to little changes in some foods that the British make or the Indian British make. And then there's a book attached to the 10-part series.
Fantastic. Is that going to air here, I wonder?
I have no idea.
Few people may know that your first major TV series was BBC produced, right? And that's still an amazing collection of... Can you talk a little bit about that?
When I was there in Britain, I had started cooking then. Then I came to America, and I lived here, got married, wrote two cookbooks here. And then the British... were looking for a TV series on Indian food, partly as an educational series, because the British needed to know more about Indians and therefore about their food. And so they auditioned a whole bunch of people there, didn't like anyone, finally heard of me, asked me to send an audition tape. And I said, I don't have a tape of any kind whatsoever. So they said, do you have an audio tape? I said, no, but I can put a... I used to teach classes to four people in my little kitchen at that time. I said, I'll put a tape on top of the fridge of my classes and I'll send that to you. So I listened to that tape after the class and it was horrible. I mean, I was stopping and starting and repeating. So I said, okay, what I'm going to do, I said into the mic, I'm going to put a tape in front of me on the table and I'm going to pretend I'm doing a half-hour class, and I'm going to just pretend and talk my way through a pretend class. So I sent them the pretend tape, and they were very happy with that. They said, if you can improvise for half an hour and just do a show, as it were, then you're hired.
You sort of invented internet radio before the internet and before radio. That's what we do. We stick a microphone in front of people and someone listens. Great. And so that series was, what was the name of the series?
That was called Indian Cookery, I think.
Right.
And there was a book to go with that. And of course, they printed 30,000 books thinking, you know, we'll have trouble selling them. They were sold first week, all
gone.
And that went on to sell over 1 million copies, that particular book. And then they did two other series. One was Far Eastern, which we traveled for, and we did 8 parts. And then I did yet another one for them, India, regional India, and that was 6 parts.
Amazing. And does your film and acting career, how is it related? Or is it just separate and because food is part of life in general, it's always together?
It's related and it's not unrelated. My niece just got a doctorate in her speech. She talked about carving a path for herself that nobody had carved before. Mm-hmm. And I suppose... I have done the same thing, which is, what am I interested in? Who am I? I'm interested in acting. I'm interested in food. And why can't I do the two together? Because that's my passion. These are what drive me. So I've forged something which, whatever it is, it's my way.
Right.
And that's what I'm doing.
And so ahead of the curve, because now you can't beat actors out of restaurants or own with chefs on TV show, all that sort of stuff. And there you are, who not just a hanger-on, but someone
I'm
who's
passionately
really,
interested in both.
Completely.
So why can't I do both? It's weird, maybe, but that's what I do.
Fantastic. So so for this project, have you been spending a lot of time in England?
Yeah, I just came back, and I'm going again next week. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of research to be done. There are towns like Leicester in England where people have come, Indians have come from Africa. You know, they were all thrown out of Africa by people like Idi Amin and various African governments threw the Indians out. And they came to what they considered second home, England. And they've set up there, and there's a wonderful combination of African, Indian, and their own community, their own particular community. That they come from. And it's amazing. I mean, I had some amazing African Indian food in Leicester. One thing was called cuckoo paka, which is cuckoo means cockadoodle, cuckoo, chicken,
rooster,
and with coconut, but done in the African Indian way. It was wonderful.
What would that, what just for everyone's edification, what would the African addition be?
Well, it was just the way it was cooked. It was a quick... slit the chicken, which is the part Indian, put the spices in, either fry it or grill it, and then make a very quick coconut sauce, spicy coconut sauce, and put it over.
Sounds great.
It is great. Yeah. It is very quick and very good.
So what do you see? Let me ask a more broad question. You here in New York, we like to think of ourselves as the center of the food world or the center of the entire world. But do you see anything that's going on that interests you, that excites you? You are, for those of you who don't know Madhur, one of the most remarkable things to me about your personality is you're always into new. You're always, as you can hear from the stories you tell, a new experience, a new thing. You're up for anything, really. Anything exciting you lately that you see in New York about food or restaurants or if...
No. I mean, I just, I don't know what to say because I'm not really somebody who goes out as much as you do, Mitch. You go out, you travel to restaurants a lot more than I do. But I do see things going away that were once very popular and new things coming in. And I think people love constant changes. Mm. I think it's this desire for new, which I find rather odd, because some of the old established, I feel like going back to the old French dishes myself, old traditional French. I long for, and I started making more and more French food at home because I just long for the butter, the cream. Not that I eat too much of it. It's not very good for me. But I long for those old-fashioned French stews and dishes of that nature. More so, I don't want the very... new with the raspberry sauce. Yes, I don't want it. And very often I will go to a very, well, let's say a very modern restaurant, and I don't like the food. I don't like the texture of the food. I just want to go back to the real texture of real food. So I'm, in a way, a rebel, rebelling against some of the very new things that people are doing. I say, well, where's the taste? I can, all right, the lichen is in my plate. I understand. And it tastes rather interesting. But where's my food? Where's my meal? I want my meal besides the lichen, you know?
Right.
So I question some of that. And I think it'll always be there. But there'll always be a kind of wonderful traditional food that I will always love.
It's funny because I've just come back from London myself from the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards. And one of the criticisms that was picked up in the press is the restaurants are also new. They're also cutting edge, and that perhaps something has been lost in the perspective of the panelists who vote, because those flavors, that level of satisfaction you get is missing in some of those experiences.
No, I totally agree. And I look at my grandson, who's 19, who's desperately interested in all kinds of the new foods, the Blumenthal's and, Noma and things like that. He's very interested in. And in fact, he's going to study in Denmark, and I'm going to give him the money to go to Noma.
It's well spent, I will say. Yeah. But, yes.
But I just feel that, to me, taste is all. Texture and taste and satisfaction is all. I like being titillated. I love being titillated. But when I sit down to a meal, satisfy me. That's the most important thing.
Interesting. Okay, there's the challenge to everyone. And it's great because next week we have Ed Baer on back in the studio. He's the editor-in-chief and publisher and bottle washer at The Art of Eating. And it's funny, he has a new book out, the 25th Anniversary Cookbook for The Art of Eating, which celebrates these traditional flavors and tastes and means of producing food. And at a recent dinner for the book that Michael Anthony did at Gramercy Tavern, he cooked the recipes. And I know exactly what you mean, because you took one bite of the guinea hen in a beautiful cream sauce with morels, and everyone, tears welled up in people's eyes. There was a sensation and a satisfaction that, oh my God, these things just tied us to something beyond what we were experiencing here, but just sort of we're part of a continuum of flavor that we forget, and that we have less and less opportunity to experience.
I yearn for something like that. Guinea hen with morel mushrooms, take me there.
Next time you're invited. Thank you so much for coming out to join us here at Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Next week, as I said, Ed Baer, we welcome from The Art of Eating. In the meantime, you can listen to our podcast and download it on iTunes or at heritageradionetwork.com, where we have an archive of all of the previous shows with all of our great guests. I'm Mitchell Davis. I'm your host. And please, before we meet again next week, eat something delicious and satisfying.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.